We come this morning for one final time to what is traditionally called the parable of the prodigal son in Luke chapter 15. And we are looking this Sunday one more time at the very end of the story. You recall how the story begins in verse 11. Jesus said there was a man who had two sons. And as the story begins, the younger son, his heart, his attitude, his actions, his circumstances, all of those things are described. He goes into the far country, is in desperate need. I will arise and go to my father. He returns. The father welcomes him. There is the robe and the new sandals and the family signet ring and a tremendous banquet, the likes of which the village had never seen, all of that provided. And you notice verse 24, "For this my son was dead," says the father, "and is alive again. He was lost and is found," and they began to celebrate. Our text begins in verse 25, "Now." Now his older brother was in the field. "And as he came and drew near to the house, he heard music and dancing, and he called one of the servants and asked what these things meant. And he said to him, 'Your brother has come, and your father has killed the fattened calf because he has received him back safe and sound.' But he was angry and refused to go in. His father came out and entreated him, but he answered his father, 'Look, these many years I have served you, and I never disobeyed your command, yet you never gave me a young goat that I might celebrate with my friends. But when this son of yours came, who has devoured your property with prostitutes, you killed the fattened calf for him.' And he said to him, 'Son, you are always with me, and all that is mine is yours. It was fitting to celebrate and be glad, for this your brother was dead and is alive. He was lost and is found.'" There was a fascinating story in the Boston Globe 30 years ago, June of 1990. It was a feature story on a very unusual wedding banquet held in downtown Boston. The way the story unfolded was this: there was an engaged couple that had gone down to the Hyatt Hotel in downtown Boston to plan their elaborate wedding celebration. And so with the event coordinator, they picked out the china, the silver, the kinds of flower arrangements they wanted. They picked out a wonderful menu to be served. And the cost of it all, $13,000. If you put it in 2020 dollars, it was $25,000 for the wedding reception. Well, the requirement was to reserve the place at the Hyatt, you had to put half down, which the bride did. Well, before the wedding ever took place, the groom backed out and decided he didn't want to get married. So the bride, crushed, "What do I do now?" went down to the Hyatt to cancel the banquet. And the events manager was understanding. She said, "I was through something like that once in my life too. I understand what you're feeling like, a little bit about your experience." But she said, "I'm sorry, the contract is binding." So she said, "You have two choices. You can cancel the banquet, but you only get $1,300 of your large down payment back. Or, I suppose if you want to, you can go ahead, pay the other half and have the banquet anyway." She thought to herself, "Hey, why not have a party?" 10 years earlier, she'd been living in a homeless shelter. And she had gotten on her feet, and she had been a tremendous success. She had the resources. So why not treat the down and out folks of Boston to a fabulous banquet? And so she sent out invitations to rescue missions and homeless shelters. And what a crowd in downtown Boston at the Hyatt that night. Waiters in tuxedos served exquisite hors d'oeuvres to elderly citizens with walkers and crutches. There were bag ladies there addicts, vagrants. They had a great time. They enjoyed chicken cordon bleu. They sipped champagne. They ate chocolate wedding cake. They danced to big band melodies long into the night. The most unlikely banquet for the most unlikely persons. This is our text, isn't it? Do you throw a banquet for somebody who does what the young son does? I mean, throws away dad's inheritance and puts the family in a financial disability? I mean, this is like the last kid you'd ever have a celebration for. But there is a banquet, and it is as lavish as the one I just described from the Boston Globe. The whole village is there. I mean, everybody is enjoying it, but there's one person who stands outside the banquet in the dark. He's angry. He is bitter. He's the older son. And if there ever was a brother who hated his sibling, it's this kid. He absolutely hated and despised his younger brother. And so as you read the text, as I did this morning, the end of this story, but when you read it for the very first time, comes as kind of a shock, because at the end of Act 1, if you will, which ends in verse 24, they're having the party, this my son was dead, he's alive, he's lost, he's found, this is a great story. Everything's back to normal, isn't it? That's sort of the way it seems. Younger son is back home with the father. The family's back intact again for the first time in who knows how long. Forgiveness has been offered. Forgiveness has been received. There's reconciliation. Conflict has been resolved. The family is gloriously reunited. And what a beautiful story of grace. And we're just content to say, the end. And they all lived happily ever after. That's kind of like, I mean, we just would wish the story ended at verse 24, but it doesn't. It's far from over, and in fact, the second act of the story, if you will, what I read this morning, is actually more important than the first part. We tend to think the story of the prodigal son, this is actually where the whole thing is headed toward. And I say that because go back and look again at the beginning of chapter 15. And I want you to notice the context of this story, because this informs how you read it. This informs how you understand the symbolism of it. This informs how you understand where's the emphasis of the story. You notice verse 2, the scribes and the Pharisees, who were they? They were the religious establishment. They were Jesus' bitter enemies. They absolutely despised and hated him. Those folks said, by way of hostility and anger and criticism, this man receives sinners and eats with them. He welcomes them. He celebrates with them. He goes to party with them, if you will. And he thinks he can bring them into the family of God without them earning their way in like we did. So that's the attitude at the beginning of the story. So with that context in mind, we realize that the end of the story that I read this morning is not simply an appendix to a warm-hearted story of a young son and a father's grace. The end of the story, the older brother part of the story, is the whole point of the story in the first place. This is where Jesus is driving toward. This isn't an afterthought. This is the climax and the height of the story right here. And so we look at this older brother. And much to our shock, we discover that this older brother who never left home is just as lost and just as alienated from dad as the younger brother ever was. And why is he alienated? What's wrong with the relationship between the father and the older son? I want you to notice verse 29. There are three phrases in verse 29 which encapsulate what was wrong in the relationship with the father and his oldest son. Notice the first phrase, verse 29. What does he say? These many years I have served you. That's the verb that summarizes in his mind his relationship with dad. I serve around here. I work like a slave around this estate, is what he says. His relationship with the Father is one of master and servant, owner and slave. That's how he looks at it. And so the relationship is totally distorted. Dad is a demanding taskmaster. There is no respect. There's no love evidenced in what he has to say. And the relationship that he had with his father, if you can call it that, is one of toil and drudgery, and you got to. Whatever it might be. So there's the problem right off the bat. Notice the second phrase. He says, I never disobeyed your command. This is this son's substitute for confession of sin. You've set a bar, I've measured up to it. Everything you've asked me to do, I have done it. That younger son of yours, he hasn't. But I work, I obey, I measure up. Why aren't you giving me a party? Why aren't you rewarding me for measuring up to the standard? What he says. Notice the third phrase in verse 29. He says, you never gave me a young goat that I might celebrate with my friends. Think about these words. He's heir to the whole estate. In fact, Dad says that to him. Now, Dad hasn't died yet, so he hasn't entered into the possession. But everything that's left, because the younger son threw away everything else, so all that's left is actually his. Two-thirds the older son, one-third the younger son, one-third's already thrown away. The rest belongs to the older son. So all the flocks, all the herds, every goat on the place, whatever else was there, it's all his. And even though it's not yet in his possession because Dad is still living and it hasn't been passed on through the will, yet what's Dad like? He's lavish. He's loving. He's over-the-top generous. That's who he is in the story. And so this young man could have had a party anytime he wanted to. But in this story, he is deeply unhappy. He is angry. He is absolutely dissatisfied. And he says to himself, I mean, what do you have to do to get a party around this place? He says. And what does the father say? Verse 31, son, you are always with me. And all that is mine is yours. But see, that didn't matter to him because he really, in his heart, didn't want to be in the father's house either. That's where this story's going. He doesn't want to be in the father's house either. He's just as lost as the younger brother. And did you notice this party business? He wants to party with his friends. He wants Dad to pay for it, but he doesn't want Dad at the party. You get that in this? Do you see the attitude? The younger son's like, I don't want Dad either. I'm actually leaving the estate. The older son doesn't dare do that. But that's his heart. He doesn't want Dad any more than the younger son does. Let me read you something from John Piper commenting on this older brother and his attitude. He writes these insightful words. Oh, how many people are in the Christian church who want out and are afraid to leave. When they hear the Father say, you are always with me, it means nothing. He is no longer their treasure. He is a means to their treasure. And if they could have their party with their friends, they would take their goat and go, says John Piper. And so behind all this older brother's, I've measured up, behind all of his outward morality and religiosity and serving and obeying commands is a heart that is far, far away from the Father. And what you realize in this amazing story is that there are two kinds of lostness. And we discover from this text that you can escape from God through morality and religion just as surely as you can escape through immorality and irreligion. Either way works. Either way works. And so while both brothers are radically different on the outside, that's evident in the story, they're equally rebels at heart. They're equally alienated from the Father. And for both of them, each in his own way, Dad is simply a means to an end. It's the only reason they, quote, care about him at all. And so this older brother, has really no sense at all of being lost. Because he measures his external obedience and says, I can't think of anything I've ever done wrong, really. I've obeyed. Tim Keller had been pastor of Redeemer Presbyterian in New York for a number of years. He writes this about the older brother. Listen to this. He says, it is not his badness that is keeping him out of the party, out of the kingdom, but his goodness. It is not his sins that are keeping him from sharing in the feast of the Father so much as his righteousness. The elder brother in the end is lost, not despite his good record, but because of it. Think about that. Because of it. And so in the story, here's the radical nature of this whole story. In the story, the one who had been the lover of prostitutes is saved, and the one who's the lover of moral righteousness is lost. This is a radical story, isn't it? And so as you look at this story, when you start out, you see the traditional depiction of sin, which all of us recognize. What is sin? Well, you see it in the younger son. It's open rebellion. It's committing outward sins that everybody can see. It's getting drunk. It's living in sexual immorality. In the story, it's leaving home, leaving the community, leaving the church. Okay, that's all sin. We recognize all of that. But with the older son, we see a depiction of sin we don't readily recognize because there's nothing outwardly to see. See, it's all in the heart. Because outwardly, he's a good neighbor, he's a faithful son, does everything he's supposed to do. We don't recognize that that posture of self-righteousness is a manifestation of sin just as surely as the open immorality of the younger brother, his actions also being sin. And so what happens in this story is when the younger son returns home, it simply brings out what was inside the older brother's heart all along. So he comes in from the field. It's the end of the day. It's getting dark. The party's already gotten underway. He doesn't want to come in. The father, you notice verse 28, goes out and pleads with him to enter. In that culture 2,000 years ago, it would have been expected that he was there. Because he was the oldest son, he would have been expected to be in charge of the banquet and all the servers, kind of like the head waiter, if you'd put it in kind of modern terms, in charge of overseeing this whole magnificent party. He wasn't interested in even going in the door. And so this older brother says, when it comes to this banquet, I'm not going in. This son of yours, notice he doesn't say, my brother. But he says to Dad, this son of yours, if he's going to be welcomed in, I don't want to be in the same room with him. I'm not coming to the party. Well, how does the story end? How does the older son respond? Does he enter the banquet hall after all? Does he join in the festivities or does he stay out in the darkness? Jesus doesn't say. John MacArthur had some very insightful thoughts along this line, the ending of the story, which just kind of ends with the father saying, it's fitting to celebrate and be glad because your son, your brother, dead, alive, lost, found. It's fitting to do it. And the story ends. John MacArthur says what we'd like is for Luke to have added verses 33, 34, and 35. Verses that we would have liked to read something like this. Verse 33, then the elder son fell on his knees before his father, saying, I repent of my bitterness. I turn from my loveless heart and my hypocritical service. I repent of my pride and self-righteousness. Forgive me, Father. Make me a true son and take me inside the feast. Verse 34, then the father embraced his firstborn son with tears, kissed him with joy, and took him into the banquet hall, seating him alongside his brother in dual seats of honor. And then verse 35. They all rejoiced together. And as the older brother entered the banquet hall, the celebration intensified. No one who was there would ever forget that night. MacArthur says we'd like if that's how the story ended. So how does it end? Well, we don't know. Or do we? Remember, in this parable, The older brother represents Jesus' bitter, hostile enemies. The religious establishment, the scribes and the Pharisees, who hated him so much, what did they want to do? They wanted to kill him several times in the Gospels. And that being so, we do find an ending then to the story. You got to get all the way over to Luke 23 to find it. But Jesus' enemies saw to it he was killed. They put him on a cross where he died in shame and disgrace and darkness on a Friday afternoon. So here is the way the story ends. MacArthur says if Luke had wanted to, knowing how it ends in chapter 23 on that Good Friday, Luke could have written verse 33 to read something like this. And the elder son was so enraged at his father that he picked up a piece of lumber and beat him to death in the darkness. That's actually how the parable ends. That's how it ends. But the violent end to the story is good news for older brothers and younger brothers alike. The end of the parable is good news because Jesus, through his death on the cross, paid for our sin and rebellion and hardness of heart and wandering away. And through his resurrection, he brings abundant life. And so through Jesus, the doors of the banquet hall are thrown as wide open as they can be. Whosoever will, let that one come. Doesn't matter if you're an older brother, the religious type, the moral type, the type everybody kind of looks up to, or whether you're the younger brother type, the doors of the banquet hall are thrown wide open so that all who turn from sin and trust in God's forgiveness through Jesus may freely enter in. So the ending of the story is for each of us one that you and I need to write, if you want to put it that way. So the banquet is there. The party's underway. The doors are wide open. And the question is, will you enter the banquet? Will you come in? Eugene Peterson writes this, "For as long as we hold on to any pretense of having it all together," that's the older brother business, isn't it? "As long as we hold on to any pretense of having it all together, we are prevented from deepening and maturing in the Christian faith. For as long as we avoid recognition of our lostness, we are prevented from experiencing the elegant profundities of foundness. For as long as we insist on maintaining safe moral grids in which we know where we stand and where everyone else stands, these poses of self-sufficiency, we disenfranchise ourselves from the company of the found sheep, the found coin, the two found brothers, and the celebrating angels." And so this morning I call to you who are older brothers. Don't continue to stand outside the banquet hall in the darkness. Enter for yourself and join in the celebration of grace.